Conscious Living and Power Radio. Glad to have you along. Wherever you are, whatever's going on, hope the weather's nice. Could be dicey. We seem to be getting a little bit. Everybody's got something funky going on this year. I'm in the Midwest in the U.S., in the United States, and it's early spring. So it's a little earlier, at least from what I'm noticing. We're having to get the flea and tick stuff out. Oh, yeah. My guest, I've actually talked with him before. Robert Kopecky is back. The first book we talked about, it was How to Survive Life and Death, A Guide for Happiness in This World and Beyond. Okay, because that was a very important thing. After you've had three near-death experiences, then it's kind of like, whoa. All right, so he got that. But now it's How to Get to Heaven Without Really Dying, Wisdom from a Near-Death Survivor. And I like that because most of us would really like a chance at that without having to go through the exit, the final exit. Hello, Robert.
Hi, Wendy. How you doing?
I'm doing good. And it's nice to talk with you. This is kind of a tag team because we talk for Wendy's Coffee House, which is on the KCMO radio. And then now we're kind of following up here. So if you've caught the other show, then this will be just a little bit different information. So pay attention because there's some good stuff here too. All right. So just to follow along. First, want to reset basically go back and say how this is three near-death experiences. And it's interesting because you talk about an out-of-body for the first one. My husband, when he was like 3 years or young kid, he saw himself as he was in the ceiling, hovering in the ceiling, and saw himself. He and his sister both got really sick. I think the mumps, measles, the three, a combo that was sent them basically almost over into heaven, but they were both, he remembered being out of body. And you explained being out of body in this first experience too, after the car accident.
Yeah, that was my first one. And like I mentioned before, it's kind of hard to get the genie back into the bottle after you have that experience. In my case, it was a single car accident. I was driving through an unfamiliar neighborhood at dusk, and I was fussing with a broken cassette player, and I glanced off an oddly parked car and went straight into a telephone pole. And almost instantaneously after that, I found myself at the top of the telephone pole, looking down at the wreck underneath, and I recognized that the person hanging out of the car, with the windshield all broken out and all that kind of stuff, was me. And I could see over hedges and bushes into people's yards and saw people coming out and calling to get an ambulance. And I saw the ambulance pull up and they put my body in the back. And I tried to talk to people, but nobody could hear me. And I did not feel alone. There was somebody with me who kind of shepherded me through what appeared to be a gray cloud bank into this kind of pastoral place. It was like a park or nature where I had an interview of sorts that was very congenial and seemed to be about some very important stuff. And 18 hours later or so, I came to in a hospital with my head all bandaged up and this unusual experience that I didn't really feel like I could tell anybody about, but that was my out-of-body experience.
Yeah, at that time, about what, mid-80s, mid-70s?
Yes, mid-80s, mid to early 80s, yeah.
Okay, so there wasn't a whole lot being talked about.
No, I think that Dr. Kenneth Ring or Raymond Moody, I think PMH Atwater, they may have had their books out or their first books out then, but there were no communities of near-death experiencers that I knew of, and really not very many people talking about it. So I didn't really have a sense of any place I could go with my story.
Yeah, I think PMH talked about hers. I think it started 1977 when she had hers. I'm just thinking it's the end of the 70s. And so, yeah, this is at that time, you're kind of, what did you do?
I think I just basically suppressed it. Kind of, I mentioned it to a couple of people and they looked at me funny, which is not unusual anyway, but they looked at me strangely, you know, and I realized that this was not something that I could talk to people about necessarily, and that I would be better off forging ahead in life. Right. And so I fell back. It was a very busy time in my life. I had a lot of this kind of ego at stake. You know, I had jobs, different jobs and relationships with people that I wanted to keep going with. So I just kind of fell back into my material life and suppressed the experience. Years.
Well, And as an illustrator, and I mean, I look at the artwork on the first book, How to Survive. It's really, I like it because it's so colorful. I love the first one. And then the second one, How to Get to Heaven. These, your illustrations, you do your artwork too.
Yeah, I did happen to be able to do the artwork for both of the covers. You know, it never really quite turns out the way that you want it to when you're picky, like most commercial artists or illustrators are. But I'm very pleased to be able to have had the opportunity, and I like the way that they look. Fun.
This is the second near-death experience. The first one, apparently you've recovered quite well and kind of pushed the whole thing aside, and then all of a sudden, slam dunk number two.
Yeah, I mean, the first one did kind of shake things up for me, and I was never quite the same. I, at one point, just decided to quit everything and travel around the world, which I did with my first wife at the time. Mm-hmm. We quit our jobs and we started traveling for a year, and we weren't particularly spiritual people, but every place we went would have told a different story, because we went to cathedrals and ruins and temples and explored the Mayan underworld and sought tiki in the South Pacific and all these things that have this kind of otherworldly or almost supernatural appeal to them. Uh-huh. Were all the places that we went to. And I ended up coming back from that trip, and nothing was working out in my life. I had been present for the death of a beloved aunt, and that really messed me up even more. And I ended up leaving my marriage, moving to New York City, and living this kind of nocturnal, bohemian, pretty self-destructive lifestyle, all downtown and all at night. And one thing led to another, and I ended up having an experience where I just had this kind of toxic response to my life and fell out on the floor of my apartment. I became essentially paralyzed. I couldn't feel my body from the neck down, and the room filled in with a brilliant white cloud. And again, I was, as in the first experience, I was kind of released from the sense of my material self. I didn't really feel that I had a body, and I felt enfolded into this field of sort of expansive, illuminative love that you hear near-death experiencers talking about. So it was a beautiful place to be, and I was directed to look into this cloud where a screen of sorts opened up and started playing these scenes from my life that were not the greatest hits. As I mentioned before, this was, you know, nothing that I wanted to save or really review. These were things that likewise I had probably kind of suppressed. Mm-hmm. These instances where I had not been present to my life with the kind of quality that I probably should have been present. These sort of seminal, pivotal moments that were life-defining in a way that I hadn't realized until I saw them again in this oddly interactive kind of a thing. It wasn't just like a film with a screen. I felt like I was there. I felt like I was in this little box of time. And then it all started to fade out when I could hear my girlfriend at the time hollering. She was really concerned about me living or not.
Yeah.
And the entire scenario sort of faded out, and I was back in reality. And about an hour or so later, I was back up on my feet and okay. But that was my second one, which was a life review of sorts, not a super comprehensive one, but this very sort of pointed or kind of customized life review.
Okay, and you spoke in the other interview when you were referring to this, saying you didn't want to, every time you remember it, the memory, you know, isn't quite the way we would like it to be. It isn't specific. So if you could illustrate an example of what kind of an issue that they were trying to show you that maybe you could go back and be more present for. Could you give an example, so you don't have to be too personal, but something that maybe would relate to other people who would know what you were talking about?
Yeah, I had a, like I told you before, I try not to talk about too many memories, additional memories that I have about the near-death experiences, because I know that memory is not all that reliable in a lot of cases.
Right.
But I did have this one memory that surfaced from those scenes of myself when I was a child, and I was threatening another little boy with kind of a homemade bow and arrow. And I didn't realize what a fragile kid this guy was at the time. Years later, it became clear, because he had a lot of sort of personal problems and stuff going through school, And he remembered that, that I had threatened him when we were just 7 or 8 years old. Mm-hmm. And so that was the kind of scene that I had, where I hadn't realized that what I was doing was having a profound and damaging effect on somebody.
Wow.
So I just was not conscious of my actions.
Yeah. Yeah. That is intense. That's why I thought, okay, there has to be a way to make this clear. Cause those are things that we just sometimes, especially as a child, you're not always going to, you might not have taken it as seriously either in doing it.
Right. Our life is full of these moments that we just roll right over, that we're so, speaking for myself, I get so caught up in my own stuff that I don't notice if I'm being a little unkind to somebody or if they're relying on me for something that I'm letting them down about, that kind of thing. So that changed my life in that way. And I did get these three lessons from the three near-death experiences.
Okay, well, then the third one, because that was number two.
So yeah, the third one, again, my least favorite way to go, if one must. I was in a small town in Arizona some years later. My life had kind of evened out, and I was pretty successful. I was traveling back and forth, sort of snowbirding. And it was a Super Bowl Sunday. I was in a public place, and I apparently caught the attention of a kind of belligerent skinhead, sort of a roughneck kid who maybe thought that I was dressed too well. I had just come from New York City to this small Arizona town. And he started to accost me, and I made a terrible mistake, which is something else that I would do differently if I could in retrospect. And I punched this guy on the chin when he came back again and started assaulting me more violently. I punched him right on the chin and knocked him flat on his back. And everybody around me thought it was a great thing that I'd done because they'd witnessed the whole thing. But as I left, I was bushwhacked by a whole gang of these guys who hit me in the back of the head with something very hard, like a tire iron or something. And I went into this place where it wasn't as heavenly as the first two. There was nothing pastoral, nothing celestial about it. It was much more kind of terrestrial feeling, or sort of like being in a womb or in a body. I still had this sense of being enfolded into this expansive matrix of loving intelligence, so to speak. You know, I was embraced by God. I felt supported and loved. But there was a group of entities there who were insisting that I had to go back, and I was insisting that I didn't want to go back. But they told me that I had not done things right, and that there were things I needed to do, that I had gotten there inappropriately, and they picked me up, as I recall, and just kind of pushed me through a membrane, and I popped back into this world on my back on the sidewalk, with an emergency medical worker over me who said, "He's back."
Yeah.
That was the third one. And so there was this kind of sense of you have a life's purpose that you have to go back and fulfill.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the three sections of the book based on these different experiences. The spiritual perspective I got from being out of body, the spiritual presence that I got from witnessing those scenes from my life, and a spiritual purpose that I got from being forced back to do it the right way.
Okay. And that's what you get into that's different from the first book. The first was How to Survive Life and Death. And it's a little bit less. This you actually go through and you work with the faculties, with compassion, with presence, with awareness that you didn't address as deeply as in the first book. And I think that's what helps, because it's like, well, what did you get from all of this? And at the first, you were just like thrilled to be back.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, the first book was really about mitigating the awfulness of death and people's fears about death and some of the ideas that we have culturally about it, based on what I had experienced of it, you know? Mm-hmm. And so the opening quote was from Woody Allen, where it's not that I'm afraid to die, I just don't want to be there when it happens, right? That was
yes.
And the new book, How to Get to Heaven Without Really Dying, without really dying is the important part, and that's based more on this Gospel of Thomas, Logion, that says the kingdom of heaven is spread across the earth, but men don't have eyes to see it. So the idea is that there are ways that we can experience this life that will provide the same kind of experience of being transcendentally connected to everything and understanding our shared purpose and being enfolded in love and supported by a greater intelligence. And so I go through sort of means that we can get there and experience in this life what I experience in the afterlife, so to speak.
Okay. And with that, just going back into it, I wanted to quickly go back. When you said there was a different way, you wouldn't have done the punch the guy back and you would have handled that differently. What could you explain how that would have been different?
Yeah. Well, the spiritual perspective, you know, we all have moments of it, I think, and it's in terms of a kind of a compassionate, kind of a detached compassion that we can have for people. When you clearly see somebody who is suffering with who they are and how they feel about themselves, and probably the cause of these, you know, karmic experiences in their life that made them need to express themselves the way that they're expressing themselves. It didn't have anything to do with me, really, that this kid accosted me. It had to do with the demons that he was living with himself. And so now I'm able to energetically recognize and interface with that kind of expression that this kid was, you know, having to express in a way that I would not punch him. I just simply wouldn't have the need to punch him. The universe reflects what we project into it, and so projecting that violence on this kid in his state was a big mistake that I don't have to make anymore. I have a more innate understanding of those life energies now than I did then.
Well, and I think, you know, that reaction at that point, did you feel like you were protecting yourself, or you just felt like you were giving him a lesson of don't mess with me?
Yeah, you know, I think it was a little combination of both. Maybe the survival instinct, which is problematic for humans, I think, because so much of it is based on the way things used to be. You know, mm-hmm. I say in the book that the only saber-toothed tigers that are out there anymore are in between our ears. So I think that I had this kind of, you know, basic survival instinct to lash out, but there was some ego in it too. It was like, I'm going to show this guy. And so that engagement in who I'm supposed to be and how I'm supposed to look and what other people will think was also an inspiration for that unwise action that I took.
Well, and then you mentioned, yeah, there were a lot of people who saw it and they all clapped. So there's the performance element.
Yeah, I didn't realize that I was performing until they applauded, but mm-hmm. then it seemed right to me. It seemed like confirmation for what I had done.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was quickly corrected by the universe.
Well, yeah. The other thing of usually those guys don't travel alone. They have a posse. And
I hadn't thought that one out, you know? Like, obviously.
Many
of the worst decisions I've made in my life, I did think a lot about, but this was not one of them.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I was just thinking that would be a good movie now that you know how this could, you know, plan the ahead, knowing that, okay, and this is part two and then part three, where we go back and pick up the pieces and say, okay, I wasn't really alone. There's part of this though, that I think is really universal. The sense that, how do you react with empathy to somebody who's angry and targeting you? And when you are, like you were, alone, there was nobody had your back. It was you and this angry person who saw you as the perfect punching bag. And when you're saying, before when we talked about it, you would take the energy and project it out and you've been able to disarm people. I would like to hear more about that.
I'm sure that's, you know, I think a big part of that is that through these experiences and ample meditation, which is the way that I have approached these sensations of heaven, again, is through meditation, along with these other principles that I'm talking about. But they make you sensitive to the fact that when you walk into a room that has a bad vibe, there really is a bad vibe. You know, there people are projecting particular energies that are based on their difficulties or the obstructions that they have to expressing themselves or expressing love. And this is a very real sixth sensory world that one can live in when one opens oneself up to engaging in those kinds of energies. This is knowledge that's been known for millennia. And in the present section of the book, I go through some of that with talking about the Dhammapada and the Bhagavad Gita and the Gospel of Thomas and the poetry of Rumi. These ancient wisdom texts that are perfectly contemporary in their description of our interface with this kind of magic of the world, these unseen energies, this invisible mechanism that exists just below the surface of this material world. And it's a very real thing that we can engage consciously and learn how to work with.
Well, part of this I see, and it's on in the chapter 8 when you're talking about presence, and that this now moment, that there is, it's a much better, I think you express a better understanding and an embodiment now, because you feel it on multiple levels, I think. And with the ego, you got through that of how it was supposed to look to somebody else, to how you actually connected and didn't worry about what it looks like to somebody else, but really paid attention. I think that's what people are right now really, really beginning to invest in and beginning to become more enlightened about, more, receptive to. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you know, consciousness is spreading into this world at an increasing rate all the time. When I was a kid, nobody cared about animals or cared about sawing down a bunch of trees or cared about recycling or any of that. And now all of that is part and parcel of our everyday life and our concerns for the planet. And that is spiritual sanity. We're all being informed all the time at this deeper level of the intelligence and beauty that exists in the world that we are really stewards of. And so that's part of the purpose chapters of the book, is that it's our job, our purpose here is to answer those calls, the calls from greater awareness and from increasing consciousness, to respond with this kind of, you know, divine consciousness, this divine understanding of a recognition of the sacred and what our role actually is in it, not just in relationships with one another, but in the way that we treat the whole world. The planet is a living thing because, you know, in many, many ways, and probably the most important one, we are the same thing. We are. That's something I came back from all three of these experiences with, is that we are the same life. You know, you, when somebody's having a hard time, you can identify immediately with them because you've been there too, right?
Yes, yes. I think part of it too, you mentioned animals as well, and I think people are much more aware of the presence in animals, whether it's a pet or a wild animal, that there is a knowing that comes from looking into that animal's eyes. And sometimes you can have a spot on immediate, just that look says, I'm paying attention, I see you. And that's extraordinary. I think that's happening more now than at any time in our previous history, at least in Western culture. This isn't something we've all been all grown up with, in at least in my little part of the world.
Yeah, and I can speak for myself clearly about this, but I think that everybody can identify with it to some degree. That is that at one point in my life, I realized I was taking part in something that I really was not feeling right about. Taking the lives of animals or considering them as less worthy of, you know, sharing divine consciousness, I started to realize there's this kind of intelligence in the connection of animals to what I call divine consciousness through the book. That people have trouble with themselves because we have these sort of ego structures, you know, who we're supposed to be, and this mind that's articulating all of these issues for us all the time, where animals are really kind of directly connected right into the source, to our divine source. And we know it. Everybody knows it. And so when you look at the way that we have as societies treated animals, I think it's hard not to have some kind of sense of guilt or uneasiness, at least, about it. And that's what happened to me. I just realized at one point in my life I could not be a party to it anymore, that it was time for me to recognize the sacred in all forms of life, not just when a cat was sitting on my lap and making me feel a lot better about my bad day, you know.
But all they're the good time, at that.
All the time.
Hang on a second here. Okay, we're going to take a break. I want to get back when we come back in this next break, and we'll talk more about animals. But you talk about the different forms of death, and you know it doesn't have to necessarily be a life and death, but a death of ego, a death of self, a death of identity, a death of false identity in some ways. So that I think you also can address as well, because having those three different, very different, unique near-death experiences, I think, gives you a little bit more insight. All right, we're coming back with Robert Kopecky and more. Be here on earth in heaven without having to die, okay? I'm just without the ladder. Back in a few.
This is a guided meditation on parenting. Take this time to breathe deeply and close your eyes. Right now, you're completely in control. Unlike the time you and your son played basketball and you attempted to slam dunk. Or when you tried removing those raccoons from the basement. Concentrate on the soothing sound of my voice. Release the memory of when you wrestled with that beehive in your son's treehouse. Let go of the time you thought that skunk was a cat, or when you pulled into the garage with your son's bike on top of the car. Deep breaths. Deep breaths.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
Did you know that 7 in 10 girls believe they are not good enough or don't measure up in some way? I'm Amy Poehler. You may know me from film and television, but I'm also involved off-screen, encouraging young girls to be proud of who they are. Body image breakdowns and the pressure to be perfect often causes a girl's self-esteem to plummet. But by being positive role models, we can change that. The number one wish among girls is for their parents to communicate better with them, including more frequent and more open conversations. So get involved and start talking. Begin a conversation with a girl in your life about the importance of self-esteem. Tell her why she is beautiful and set an example by avoiding negative self-talk. You can make a difference in the lives of girls, and that is no laughing matter.
This message was brought to you by American Women in Radio and Television and was made possible through the generous support of the Dove Self-Esteem Fund, working together to raise self-esteem in girls everywhere. To learn more, go to Campaign for Real Beauty.com. Thank you for making a difference.
When Dad needed help getting around, I became his driver. Any daughter would do the same. But soon enough, he needed help doing more things, and it was up to me to be his personal shopper and financial manager, too. And before I knew it, Dad moved in with me. So I became his cook, his personal assistant, his physical therapist, and even his nurse. When I started taking care of Dad, I didn't realize all the roles I'd have to play. But no matter what, I know I'm still his daughter.
We understand the many roles you play. And to help, we created an online caregiving resource center. At aarp.org/caregiving, you can find resources and connect with the caregiving community. Together, we can better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving to learn more. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Conscious Living and Power Radio. Thank you for tuning in. My guest, Robert Kopecky. And we've got a couple of books. Okay, if you haven't read the first, you can just basically try, start with the first, How to Survive Life and Death. This is good. A Guide to Happiness in This World and Beyond. All right. So that'll get you kind of set for the next book. How to Get to Heaven Without Really Dying is important. Okay. The without really dying part is kind of like the essential. You would agree with that, right, Robert?
Absolutely, yes. That's why I wrote the book, is so that you can avoid, do not do it like I did. That's
well, I like the part where you said that last one. And that was an intense experience, being beaten up by a bunch of guys. And that was that's nobody. I've heard a lot of those stories, and they don't have happy endings. And in the meantime, though, you were saying, okay, I'm done. I'll stay here. And they said, no, sorry. That had to be tough.
Right. No, you got to go back. And that's something that a number of near-death experiencers will report on, is that being forced back into this life to do what you're supposed to do. And that's it's an interesting thing you were talking about, what kind of death we have to die. You know, there were different kinds of dying and stuff. If we're alive before birth and we're alive after death, which I am here to report on, then what exactly is the point of dying? You know, why do you, if we're eternal beings, why do we have to go through this?
Yes.
It seems a little difficult and dangerous and all of that kind of stuff. Well, aside from being in the afterlife, near-death experiencers all having this consistent experience of being enfolded in love and having a sense of being totally connected and an understanding of our purpose, there's also an aspect of receiving instruction or receiving guidance. In my three experiences, that was the case. I was at some point, like, you know, required to receive guidance and to respond to it. And so becoming teachable, I think, is a big part of why our soul seems to require the death experience for us to enter heaven, so to speak. So if we die, actually die physically, then we immediately hit a reset button. It's kind of a reboot, to use a technological term.
Yeah.
Into this expansive new reality where anything goes. We're no longer limited by our material forms and stuff. But in this life alone, for me, I know I didn't really learn these lessons of the near-death experiences I had until I had experienced this set of circumstances where everything in my life stopped working. My whole sense of myself fell apart. And I had that moment of absolute humility, this kind of ego death, where I became teachable, where I became capable of evolving spiritually, of growing spiritually from that place. And so that's what I believe these death experiences are, whether it's having a pet die or losing a job or having a lover leave you or having somebody that you love die. It resets us in a place of humility where we again get to reassess what's important in our lives and how we can improve on that and heighten that experience. And that's how we're finding heaven. That's how we use the death experience to get to heaven, is the way that I describe it.
I remember going through a time in my life when I was identified with my job. That was that's how I packaged myself, and how, you know, somebody says, well, what do you do? Well, this is what I do. And I always had an answer, and losing that meant I had to figure out, what do I do? And how do I have value? Because I don't have that thing that defined me. And that was a big moment of soul searching and trying to figure out, well, I existed before I had that job and I exist now. And how did I let that take over my identity and my definition? And it just happened, you know, small little baby steps. But when it happened, it was really an eye-opening experience that, my gosh, I lost part of me by doing that. And I think that's what you're describing in that near-death experience, is that, you know, the identity and figuring out, well, who am I? And you talk about knowing your purpose. And I think that's unique to each person, each experiencer who comes back and suddenly says, well, okay, maybe I want to actually participate instead of just coasting or hanging my hat and saying, this is what matters, this is what I am. And I think in reading your information, you know, you with that presence, being here now and being in the moment and going back and making an effort to really appreciate fully what's happening around you in each given day. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. That's exactly what I talk about, is that there's an opportunity to engage in life with a whole different quality of living that's not dependent on these material definitions that are always changing. They come and go. It's, you know, it's like Buddhism, right? I mean, these things are always changing, and there's the ego mind will attach yourself and your sense of identity to it, but you are not your ego mind. You are an authentic spiritual being that is engaged in life at a much more profound level than just what job you have or what kind of clothes you wear, or car you drive, that sort of thing. Those things come and go. There's a great grammatical trick that I use that comes from Ramana Maharshi, who was a great 20th century Swami, and he said the problem with I am this or that is the this or that. I'm paraphrasing him.
Yes, it's
a great trick, right? Uh-huh. I am a doctor. I am a wealthy person. I am smarter than other people. It's the back half of that that's all the trouble back there.
Right.
And if you just drop all of that, then you're left with I am, which is
frightened,
grounding you in the eternal moment, kind of, you know.
Yes.
No, frightened is another egoic structure because that's imagination. That's oftentimes,
yes,
unless a bear is chasing you or something, you know,
uh-huh,
or your house is on fire, then most of our fears are manufactured by the ego. It's, you know, still afraid of a saber-toothed tiger behind the bush. I mean, that's what it's still apparently thinking about, right? So everything looks like it's out to get you and stuff, and it's not true at all. And you can ground yourself in this sort of awareness of in the eternal moment by saying, I am not afraid, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and part of it, too, is that it's like worry. You know, the more you invest yourself in that external, whether it's a projection of fear, a projection of worry, a projection of inadequacy, a projection of superiority, that isn't you. It's that again,
right,
all of that energy being put into something external instead of saying, I am, and then allowing that to demonstrate. I think there's a part in there where you're talking about, and to me, I just translated it, so I can't remember what part of the book it's in, where it to me became clear you were less concerned about becoming something else. And I thought were more peaceful, at peace, and just being you. You didn't have to put on an affectation. You didn't have to put on some other role. You could just relax and say, okay, now I can experience being here. And that's how I interpreted it.
Well, that's a great thing about the death experience that we're talking about, is that it delivers us to this place. You know, when people say, look into the pain, the Sufis say, look into the pain, because if you turn around 180 degrees, you see bliss, right?
Yeah.
That you have this experience that eliminates all of those constructions that you had that were defining you. Suddenly, you're in a reset button. You're in a place of real authenticity where you find out, you know, who you really are. You know, when you lose your job or you lose your best friend or something like that happens that puts you in that place of humility where you become teachable, then you can really grow from that without any of this stuff in the way anymore. And I believe that's what the death experience does for us.
There's a part when you get into this, the presence that lasts, and you talk about basically truth. Stop lying, tell the truth. Now that's really tough. That's because some things you don't even know that you're being deceptive about,
right?
Because they're things that you acquired from childhood. This is, you know, could you address a little bit more of that?
Sure. Yeah. And this is part of what heaven is. You know, when you think about your ideas of heaven, heaven is a nice place where everybody is very kind there. Heaven is a truthful place, so everybody is very honest there. And so we need to be kind and honest to align ourselves with what heaven is, so to speak, to manifest it here on this life. And you can't do that by lying to people or manipulating them. You know, I've had these experiences, and I write about it in the book, where I just terribly embarrassed myself being caught in a horrible lie. And, you know, hopefully I learned from that.
Hopefully.
That life could be much simpler and much truer and much more this kind of heavenly experience if I just don't do that, you know, if I'm just honest. And when you get accustomed to being honest, then you start to realize, oh, that's something that I've always said that isn't necessarily true. You have these aha moments, right?
Yes.
And then your BS meter expands too. So you can see other people, you can witness the inauthenticity of their message coming through them, you know, in a way that is obviously not true. So you can witness other people's baloney because you get in touch with your own. And then these things start to reveal themselves to you. These lies that you've told yourself, things that you have suppressed that have had destructive results in your life. There's a great Gospel of Thomas expression, too, where Yeshua says, that which is within you, if you bring it forth, it will save you. If you do not bring it forth, it will destroy you, which predates modern psychology by a couple thousand years, and talks about that really being able to be honest with yourself. And then you can really be honest with others. And that creates a quality of life that's just far superior to the alternative.
There's a difference in the body energy when somebody is authentic and
Absolutely.
Allows themselves to be, and you know, when you're honest, sometimes you're vulnerable and there's that sense of there is no barrier. There is no shield. There's no wall. There's just that. And again, that's the presence of being authentic and allowing the other person to either make a judgment or accept you, whatever. It's not your problem anymore. It's just,
exactly.
this is what it is.
Yeah.
Go ahead. That's what you're doing when you're being honest.
Absolutely. And in heaven, there is no pretense, right? Nobody is pretending to be. They're not bragging. They're not boasting. They're not aggressive. They're not overbearing. They're not desperate, right? There is none of that. They're not competitive. There is none of that kind of representation of oneself as being something that you have to fear or respect. There's no self-enhancement at all, which an awful lot of dishonesty, self-dishonesty is about. You're kind of lying to yourself about how important you are or aren't because you wish you were, you know? But without all of that stuff, you can live just a much lighter, more open, kind of engaged, present life. Where you don't have to drag all this luggage around with you all the time and explain it constantly.
You've done a lot of self-examination, and there's in the book you're talking about a part where an exercise to open your heart. I think that's a good one to share.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I remember which.
It's being more heart open-hearted, and now I've buzzed past it. I'm on my
computer.
Yeah,
no, but being open-hearted, we all understand because you see like a video of a kitten that is kneading on top of a big dog, right?
Yes.
And the dog is kind of like going, oh, okay, but it licks the kitten and the kitten curls up on it and your heart just opens up in that moment. Mm.
Yeah.
Even if you're watching it at the office when you're not supposed to be watching it, you know, it like start kind of saves that moment.
Nobody
of your
does
day
that.
And that moment, you have that heavenly experience of open-heartedness where you can recognize the beauty that's alive in all things and even sometimes the smallest and most mundane things. So an exercise in that respect would be just to go about your day trying to be as authentically kind as you can be to people and just witness the kindnesses that are happening around you and the kinds of beautiful little scenes that life presents you that if you're not worrying about your own stuff, you can engage in a much more authentic and a sincere way, if you know what I mean. And experience this kind of magic that's going on all the time. And then you're projecting that, too. You're creating more of that in your world. And the world starts to reflect that back to you, too. So open-heartedness is like a key to an extra-dimensional experience of life, an extra-sensory experience.
Well, and you're talking about in discovering divine purpose, the personal actions. And that's part of it, you know, is being present for the actions. And you're talking in that chapter, you mentioned a lot of Rumi, you pull that in, but the the friend realizing the presence of the beloved in all forms. So like in my dog, Jack, you know, seeing him as needing attention, needing to be respected when he has an issue, like I have to take him to the vet, whatever, and not putting that off for 6 weeks, but being present in the moment for others, whether it's a person, for a plant, for the environment, and stepping up and I think being actually more aware of the entangled lives that we have. We are exactly. Part of this. We're not just an accessory. We belong with all of these elements of our planet. And I think you get into that by saying, you know, personal action, taking, I think responsibility would express that.
Yeah, that quantum characteristic is more than a metaphor. We are entangled with everything. And when you have that kind of presence of being and that open-hearted awareness of your dog, for example, your dog is telling you what your purpose is. He needs you to be who you are for him. He's there because he's completing you energetically and karmically. We're all connected on all these various levels of being that when you open yourself up to, your life is transformed and you're no longer subject to just this simple, serial, I got to do this, I got to do that, these people think this of me, I've got to show up for, you know, all of that kind of experience of life, which is, you know, it's sort of a hamster wheel of sorts.
Yeah.
Instead, life becomes this experience that near-death experiencers talk about. You become enfolded in this kind of fabric of love and inclusion, a transcendent sense of total connectedness to everything, this innate understanding of what your purpose is. What do people like you to do? What do people need you to do? What does your pet want from you? What is the world telling you you need to recycle, or you need to show up for a rally, or, you know, vote a certain way? I mean, our engagement with all of life changes when we open ourselves up in this sixth sensory way, so to speak.
You have had three near-death experiences, so it's opened you up to a new crowd, a new group of people who really appreciate your presence and the things that you have to say. In the book, you talk about a woman who was dealing with death, and I think it was significant that you were in the right place at the right time to express to her, you know, a lot of times we think that our actions need to be billboard huge to make a difference or to be important, but she was there helping somebody else transition. And if you could share that, because I think it's a powerful message.
Yeah, well, that's the problem with the ego getting involved in your sense of purpose, is that my ego thinks that Martin Scorsese should hire me to be the lead in his next movie. You know?
That ego, yeah.
Uh-huh. Or, you know, I should be elected to some office there, or given the powers of Superman so I can fix the world or something like that. But the fact is that what we're really called upon to do is equally as magic and remarkable, but oftentimes it's a very simple, very personal relationship we have karmically with our own life and with the people in it. Where if we're showing up for somebody who is ill, who may be, you know, in the course of transitioning, who may be on their way out of this world, that's a sacred calling that we need to step up to and show up for. That's our purpose. You know, I was using this woman as an example of purpose because her life had been a series of caretaking for people when they were in terrible places and possibly dying, and she'd had a lot of that in her life. And she was talking about it all and said, you know, I never imagined that this would be what my life is. And I said, but your life seems to me to be this incredible calling, this blessing of being there for people to share in this kind of sacred bubble of being with them. You know, it's a miraculous thing. And she just kind of looked at me and said, I know, and smiled, you know. And in that moment, my open-heartedness just kind of collapsed in around her like a big hug. It's like, that's what we're talking about. That's a sense of one's true purpose, not where the ego jumps in and defines it as not being what you want, but on opening you up to what you are and what you can be.
Okay. So in doing all of this, and I'll mention, I know that your relationships have changed since you've had these experiences. And, you know, you mentioned the girlfriend and the ex-wife, you know, those relationships. But part of that was the transition of becoming more present. How does that affect your relationships now?
Well, becoming more present changed things for me in a great number of ways. But one of them was that I started recognizing synchronicities, and a pretty profound synchronicity led me to my wife now. You know, I was actually signing papers that had her name on them, and I didn't realize it was her name until I bumped into her later, and she wrote it on a piece of paper, and I looked at the piece of paper and said, you know, I've been signing papers from Pike County all day long, and that's your name, is Pike. And so when I entered into the relationship with her then, with, you know, the years of meditation and ruminating over these three experiences, I can enter into it in a more open-hearted way, where I understand that there's some kind of completion of a whole that's taking place. And this is the sort of Sufism thing with Rumi, you know, where you recognize the other as being there to make you whole within the beloved, to make you a part of everything. And I have that now with as many people as I can possibly manage it. And even when I'm with strangers, I try to look at them with what I call angel eyes, which is where we simply get rid of all of our judgment and comparison and all of our labels, and just experience a person as the expression of divine consciousness coming through them. You can begin to see their needs and what has affected them and made them the way that they are. And you understand how much love is there in their makeup and how much love you may need to bring to it. And so we complete one another in that sense in all of our relationships. There's something funny about the way we meet each other and why we're in one another's lives that seems pretty intentional lots of times, and I think that it is.
Well, I agree, and we're going to have to wrap up, but I do want to, the purpose finder in your book, I think, is a great exercise for anybody who is waffling or thinking, how do I know? This is so easy. It's not rocket science, and anybody can do it. I think it's brilliant.
You kind of fill in the blanks or something, and you get your purpose out of it.
Well, it's simple, and sometimes it seems like it'd be so difficult.
Yeah, that's because our ego wants to make all kinds of things out of it, when lots of times it's really right in front of us. You know, what do you do well? What do people love you for? What do people need you for? This directs you to your purpose. You know, what does the earth need? What does the earth need?
Kinder and gentler people who inhabit it. That's for sure.
There you go. See?
And that's overview. All right. Well, we're going to have to get out of here, but I do appreciate your time. And I know that a lot of people at this point are ready to hear the message that the energy, you know, change your energy, look at the other person in a different way instead of judging and assuming that you have to respond with anger. Thing I do want to mention, though, your website, and if you would do me a favor and tell people how they can get in touch with you.
Sure. Yeah. My website is www.robertkopecky.com, and my blog, robertkopecky.blogspot.com, is where I publish and post lots of events and lots of essays and stuff like that too. And it has both of them have contact buttons on them, so you can contact me directly.
I love the website and the blog. I like the blog because you freshen that up a lot, and I'm a blog person anyway. So if you're listening, How to Survive Life and Death, that's the first one. Okay, you might have already read it. Well, the next one now is How to Get to Heaven. It's got a little ladder just in case you're confused at which direction heaven might be. It's up, okay? And you never know. You never know. So in the meantime, though, you know, we do want to mention Sue is your companion, and she works with animals, which is why you might also have a better understanding too of how important they are and the dynamic they play in relationships too. So, I mean, that's another significant, I think, factor presence in your life that you expanded. You got Sue and you got the animal world that comes with her.
Absolutely. Evidence of the unseen all the time. Sue Pike, the animal talker, is what she's called.
Yes. Yes. And I've talked with her before, so you can check that in the archives here, too, on Empower Radio. The other thing I want to say real quickly is that when you are looking for something that defines your life and gives it purpose, what was the first thing after you came back, you decided what was the role you needed to play or you were going to be?
To remove the obstacles to love in my life. And it flowing into me, and it flowing around me, and through me, and out of me, and in defining where I wanted to go, what direction to follow the love in my life. And that was that's the most important thing, I think, still and always for me.
Thank you. Yeah, sometimes it's just that simple thing of saying, okay, this is important, and how did I miss that when I got here? It got so complicated so fast. And going back to the basics, that's when it's missing, that's what you miss.
Is it love, or is it not love? And maybe I should bring some if it's not.
Well, we got to go. So thank you so much. I appreciate, again, Robert Kopecky. Check out the website, robertkopecky.com. And whatever you're doing, wherever you're at, right place, right time. There are no accidents. There are no mistakes. There's just a learning curve. So stay positive, stay curious, and enjoy your life. See ya.